This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Earlier this week, Israel launched a particularly large military operation involving ground forces against Palestinian militants in the town of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. The troops have now withdrawn, leaving 13 dead, 12 of them Palestinians. It's 30 years since the Oslo Accords were signed in Washington, D.C., a process aimed at establishing an Israeli-Palestinian peace treaty. Since the turn of the millennium, the process has stuttered and stumbled. There have been uprisings or intifadas, rockets, airstrikes and incursions. And in recent years, the process has apparently stopped altogether. Why? And what are the chances of it ever being resurrected? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what happened in Jenin and why? Joining me in the briefing room from Jerusalem is Yolande Nell, the BBC's Middle East correspondent, who's just back from the town. Yolande, where exactly is Jenin and what kind of place is it?
Jenin is basically a rural market town. It's far north in the West Bank, a bit off the beaten track. It's about 3 miles from the Green Line, which is based on the 1948 ceasefire line. So that means that some of those Palestinian refugees who live there in its big refugee camp can look across to the fields that now lie in Israel, where their parents, their grandparents came from. You see their high poverty rates and high unemployment compared to other parts of the West Bank. A lot of people still work in agriculture. And, you know, driving around, you get the idea it's much more open, it's more beautiful, less hemmed in than other parts of the West Bank, you know, if you come closer to Jerusalem. There's also, I should say, a bleaker picture there in recent months. You know, if you go to 2005, when the Israelis withdrew from Gaza, they also dismantled 4 settlements, which are quite close to Jenin. And now we're seeing at least one of those, one called Homesh, being re-established under the new Israeli government.
And who actually runs Jenin?
I mean, Jenin falls under the auspices of the Palestinian Authority. But at the same time, you can see that in places like Jenin, the Palestinian Authority is really especially seen as weak, it's seen as unpopular. We actually saw clashes with locals and the Palestinian Authority security forces at the end of the Israeli military operation. You could get a sense of how much disdain there is for the Palestinian Authority. And you get a strong impression in places like Jenin, and particularly, of course, in the refugee camp where services are provided by the United Nations Agency for Palestinian refugees. You get the idea that the PA is not in control of these areas.
Right. Now, remind us why the Israelis said they went into Jenin.
justification that was given by the Israeli military was that some 50 shooting attacks targeting Israelis had come from the Jenin area in the past 9 months. They said that the Jenin refugee camp specifically had become a safe haven or a hornet's nest for militants, and they wanted to go in there focusing on weapons, what they called terrorist infrastructure. They pointed out that a lot of Palestinians who had carried out attacks often had gone to this refugee camp as a kind of safe haven. We do know that there are a few hundred armed fighters who are inside the camp. Many of them belong to the Jenin Brigades, and it was actually an apartment being used as their headquarters that was targeted by the unusual use of an airstrike by a drone, the first act of this Israeli operation.
So, Yolande, who are the Jenin Brigades?
The Jenin Brigades, made up of different Palestinian factions and others who maybe have no affiliation or a loose affiliation. And actually, that gives some inspiration, I would say, to Palestinians in general, because these are normally competing groups that they're part of. But in Jenin, they're seen as being united in their cause of what's seen as resistance to the Israeli military occupation of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Otherwise, you could say that Jenin, anyway, is a stronghold in the West Bank for Hamas, which is, of course, the Islamist militant group which governs Gaza, also of Islamic Jihad. And that's the second largest militant group, which also has its stronghold in Gaza. Now, on top of that, you know, many people in the younger generation, the younger Palestinian generation, and if you look at the 12 killed in Jenin that we know about, they're teenaged boys, 16 and 17. The oldest is someone in their early 20s. So these are people who are often born after the end of the second Intifada or Palestinian uprising, which I guess faded away in about 2005, 2006. These are young people who are acting more on their own initiative. They're not really feeling that they have to answer to the established militant groups or to established political parties. In fact, often they feel disillusioned with them.
So they're not part of any strategy, as far as you know, Yolande.
Broadly speaking, their aim is opposition to Israel's ongoing military occupation of the West Bank. A lot of the shooting attacks that have been carried out are targeting Israeli soldiers and Jewish settlers. But of course, you know, there have also been other attacks that have been carried out inside Israel, killing civilians in places like Tel Aviv. These militants consider regular Israeli civilians legitimate targets too. Those who are associated with Hamas and Islamic Jihad or some of its ideology have never given up their commitment to what we'd call armed struggle. They don't recognize Israel's right to exist. And so, you know, that's why they're seen, of course, as terrorist groups by Israel, but also a lot of the international community.
And finally, Yolande, how much popular support do they have?
In Jenin, there was one man who was telling us, you know, that the world often makes these divisions into militants and civilians. But in the refugee camp, he said, we see the militants as our sons and our brothers. You know, there are a lot of Palestinians in general that keep their old allegiances to a particular political faction. But we have seen a lot of support for those political factions dropping off.
Yolande Nell. Now, I want an analysis of how Israelis and Israeli politicians understand the problem of achieving peace. Anshul Pfeffer is Israel correspondent at The Economist, and he's also in Jerusalem. Anshul Pfeffer, I'm old enough to remember when the Oslo Accords were signed back in the early 90s. Back then, was there a feeling within Israel that a long-term peace was actually possible?
I think there was, at the early stage, a lot of euphoria. Just the fact that then Israel's Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, was signing an agreement alongside the PLO's most famous leader, Yasser Arafat, really was a euphoric moment. And for a brief while, I think a majority of Israelis did believe that peace was achievable.
Now, this was predicated on the idea that there was going to be this famous two-state solution. What was the two-state solution seen as being?
Well, that's where there's a lot of misconceptions, because it wasn't predicated on the two-state solution. Oslo Accords was a preliminary agreement which would lead to further negotiations and a more comprehensive final agreement. And certainly in the first years of Oslo, it wasn't at all clear to many Israelis, you know, whether it would be an actual Palestinian state.
Anshul, how strong was the support for the Oslo process in Israel at the time, and how strong was the opposition to such an agreement?
Well, it was fluctuating. I think, you know, like I said, in the first few months, there was a lot of euphoria. And from polls at the time, there was a majority of Israelis in favour, but it was never a very large majority. And when in that, in those first couple of years of the process, when Arafat and the Palestinian Authority established itself first in Gaza and then in parts of the West Bank, when Hamas and various other Palestinian organizations began its campaign of suicide bombings within Israel, a lot of that support evaporated. And I think by the time Rabin was assassinated in late 1995, I think a majority, certainly from the surveys at the time, of Israelis were not in favor of the process.
So essentially, the peace movement, if we call it that, in Israel was destroyed as a major movement in those years.
Well, it's gone up and down. I mean, we saw afterwards in 1999 that Ehud Barak, who was somebody who was going to take the process with the Palestinians to the next step, won the elections by a considerable margin. So there was once again a period in which Israelis were willing to accept some kind of two-state solution. That once again went up in smoke when the Second Intifada began, and with it another series of suicide attacks in Israel. So I think that the Israeli public, and we've seen this in a quarter of a century of polling, have been willing to accept in principle the idea of an historic compromise with the Palestinians. But when you look at the Israeli election results, you see that they don't trust any leader to actually go ahead and do that. So it's not so much about the theoretical idea of a two-state solution. The question is, are there the politicians, are there the leaders, and is there the trust from the Israeli public in that leadership to do that?
So we have these brief moments of hope, which, according to you, end really at the turn of the millennium, around about 2000 and just beyond. What, when Israelis do think about the situation with the Palestinians, do they still believe that some kind of two-state solution is possible?
The problem is with the word two-state solution is where you put the emphasis. If you put the word emphasis on two-state, then you're getting into the more pragmatic discussion of what shape should the solution be. But the emphasis should be in the word solution. Do Israelis feel that they need to solve the conflict? Do they feel that the conflict is so central to their lives? Do they feel that the conflict is costing them in any major way that weighs down upon them, and therefore it needs to be solved? And what we've seen in the last decade or so in Israel is that most Israelis don't feel that they need a solution right now. This is partly because the way in which it was presented to Israelis for so many years, that if we don't solve the conflict, if we don't end the occupation in the West Bank, then the world will put so much pressure on us, and there'll be boycotts and sanctions, and Israel will become an international pariah, and therefore we need to solve the conflict and end the occupation before that happens. But what has happened is that Israel has come no closer to solving the conflict. The solution seems more remote than ever. And despite that, Israel's international trade has quadrupled over the last 20 years. GDP is now rivaling that of Britain. Israel has more diplomatic relationships with the countries than ever, including a growing number of Arab countries. And all this despite the fact that the Palestinian issue is so far from being solved. So the entire argument in favor of solving the conflict, that Israel needs to do that to be able to be a part of the family of nations, to have a Western level of prosperity and trade, that has turned out to be false.
Anshul, one of the other arguments that was always proffered for some kind of settlement was that Israel found itself effectively ruling an increasingly large number of people who did not actually participate in Israel's politics. In other words, that they had created an impossible demographic situation. Why has that argument not been very big in recent years?
Well, there's two main reasons for that. The first is that the argument can be made, but most Israelis don't feel the demographics in their daily life. They're living in their towns, in their neighborhoods. The Palestinians are mainly in the West Bank or in Arab Israeli towns. And I think the other thing is that generations of Israeli politicians have managed to cast the issue of the occupied territories in this sort of otherworldly limbo. And it's still sort of a temporary occupied status waiting to be resolved, but who knows when it will be resolved. And therefore, Israelis don't feel that they are in a situation where there's another population, which is almost the same, or by some counts, the same size or even larger than Israeli Jewish population. It's simply not a feature of life for Israelis. And instead of that, they feel that every time there has been an effort to try and solve the situation. It's, you know, they've been greeted by intifadas, by suicide bombings. But you know, when Israel, after Israel retreated from the Gaza Strip, then there were rocket launches. In the Israeli mind, every time Israel's made an attempt to try and solve this, the result has been violence and death for Israelis. And therefore, why bother if you don't really feel this in your daily life?
Anshul Pfeffer. And what about the Palestinian analysis? Professor Khalil Shikaki is director of the Palestinian Centre for Policy and Research and joins us from Ramallah. Khalil Shikaki, when the Oslo Accords were signed, was there a feeling within the Palestinian mainstream that at that point a long-term settlement was possible?
Yes, indeed. There was significant optimism in the air. The Palestinian state was on its way. Occupation was about to end, and Palestinian-Israeli peace was finally at hand. The prevailing perception at that time was clearly evident that we have a majority of the Palestinian public, at least two-thirds, who indeed viewed this as a positive development and supported it.
At that point, do you recall what kind of end solution was imagined, what those two states would look like from the Palestinian point of view?
For Palestinians, the two-state solution is essentially about separation and partition. Separation between the two peoples in two different states and partition of the land, one being Palestine based on the lines of 1967 and with East Jerusalem as its capital, and the other being the state of Israel. So the separation or partition idea is one that essentially the overwhelming majority of the Palestinians at one time thought is the future and supported that idea. This is the idea that is now essentially being challenged.
Right. That was the mainstream position, but there was also opposition, wasn't there, from, I think they were called at that stage, rejectionists. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, there were rejectionists, just as the case was in Israel. In both Israel and Palestine, more than two-thirds of the public supported this vision. Among the Palestinians, the support for the vision of a two-state solution, this is going beyond the Oslo Agreement, was supported by almost 80% of the Palestinian public. They differed on the Oslo terms and whether it meets that requirement or not. But there was at least 20% of the Palestinians who were supporters of Hamas at that time and who opposed Oslo very strongly, even violently, and did not support the vision of a two-state solution. But the overwhelming majority did.
But subsequently, in effect, the movement towards peace collapsed. What was the Palestinian analysis of what happened?
Essentially, the belief that the state of Israel was not committed to full implementation of that agreement. Everything was postponed, and that created some suspicion that Israel may not be interested in implementing it. But most importantly, the Israeli state continued to build settlements right inside the future Palestinian state, and Palestinians saw this to be in total contradiction with the vision, but also the terms of the agreement that required that there would be no change in the territorial status quo as depicted in the Oslo Agreement.
One of the things that happened in the subsequent period, presumably after that became a widespread Palestinian perception, was the Second Intifada or uprising. Can you tell us what impact that had upon Palestinian politics?
The Oslo failures essentially led to the Second Intifada, which erupted 7 years after the signing of the Oslo Agreement. At that point, most Palestinians saw the Oslo Agreement failing them in ending the Israeli occupation, stopping settlements. And that left a very important mark on the environment as a whole. There was significant erosion in support for diplomacy and growing support for violence among the Palestinians, and greater skepticism about the commitment of Israel and the belief of the Palestinians that there was a partner on the other side started to collapse with the beginning of the Second Intifada and the failure to reach an agreement at Camp David, which preceded the eruption of the Second Intifada by about 3 months.
Now, one of the consequences, it seemed, of this was the set of elections for the Palestinian Authority that saw effectively a division between the West Bank and Gaza. Can you just tell us a bit about that?
Sure. 6 years after the eruption of the Second Intifada, we had parliamentary elections. A year before, we had presidential elections. And in those presidential elections, Mahmoud Abbas, the current president, was elected for a 5-year term. And 2006, we had parliamentary elections in which Hamas won the majority of the seats, but not the majority of public support. Hamas only won 44% of the popular vote. Secularists and nationalists won 56% of the vote. As a result, with Abbas being president, of representing secular nationalists and Fedahan and other factions, and Hamas winning the parliamentary seats, we saw a situation in which the issue of governance became extremely difficult. Eventually, the inability of the Palestinians among themselves to find a way out of this mess led to the split between the West Bank and Gaza, and Hamas took over control of the Gaza Strip. While in the West Bank, the Palestinian president continued to have loyalty and support of the security services, and he appointed a new government in the West Bank, which meant essentially the political system was split right in the middle between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
Now, what is it, if we look at the mainstream Palestinian strategy, what is it that we can say their belief is about how to achieve some kind of settlement? Or do they, in fact, still believe that some kind of settlement is possible?
The public at large does not believe that some kind of settlement is feasible. And so the support for the two-state solution, for example, which has been the paradigm that have guided all negotiations since Oslo and even before that, is no longer seen as viable by the overwhelming majority of the Palestinian public.
If that's the case, what do they believe that Palestinian politicians ought to be working towards?
The society is divided. There is no majority today in favor of any solution. We essentially have three solutions. The one that is favored by Hamas, which does not want to reach a two-state agreement. It believes all of Palestine belongs to the Palestinians. And then the state of Israel does not have legitimacy. And this is about the view of about a quarter of the Palestinians based on our surveys. There is slightly more than that, less than a third, but more than a quarter, who believes that a two-state solution, despite the difficulty of reaching one, is still the preferred solution. And we have about a third which believes that we should now abandon the demand for sovereignty and independence and demand equal rights to live in a single state in historic Palestine with Israeli Jews, where Jews and Palestinians would have equal rights, one person, one vote. And that should be the way things should go. Equal rights, a democracy in a future joint state.
Khalil Shikaki, what about the rest of us? Where does the international community fit in? David Makovsky is Ziegler Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute and Director of the Correct Project on Arab-Israel Relations. David Makovsky, is the view of the West, do you think, still that a two-state solution is the only solution to the conflict?
That has traditionally been the view, yes, because it's the one way to give dignity for both sides and to enable both sides to maintain their own nationalist aspirations for a state of their own.
Right. Now, is there a difference between the formal diplomatic view that that is the solution and the private realpolitik policy view of what is being pursued?
Well, right now, there's a lot of despair, I would say, because there's a sense that the leadership on both sides does not believe a deal is attainable. The idea of compromise would create too much backlash within the base of the constituency of each leader, that each side will be pilloried, not just for the concession, but for the question of will it be enforced? Even if a deal is struck, can it be maintained? And here, I think there's some interesting differences. The Israelis are worried that you make a deal with Abbas, who's got a suit and a tie and may sound very reasonable, and yet he's not strong enough, and Hamas will kind of gobble him up the way they did in 2007 in Gaza. And so you're making a deal with someone who really can't maintain the deal. The Palestinians are very skeptical that you have to compromise on refugees. Every refugee could come to Palestine, of course. But, you know, we told all the refugees they can have their keys from their homes of 1948 and they go back to what's now Israel. But Israel's really not going to accept that. So if we compromise on that, we'll be hurt. The issue of Jerusalem is so religiously charged for both sides that neither side wants to compromise and kind of prefers the status quo, which is certain, versus the risk of a deal that it will be viewed as insufficient by both camps.
Right, and that's broadly the perception of the United States diplomats, that's the situation. Is that perception broadly shared by the United States allies? Would European diplomats share that perception?
I think everyone agrees on that.
What about the position of the Arab states? Because another major change in the course of the last couple of years has been the relationships between Israel and Saudi and the Gulf states. What impact do you think that's had?
Look, that's also part of this impasse in that the Arab states in 2002 agreed to something called the Arab Peace Initiative, which was very backloaded. Israel, give the Palestinians whatever they want. If you give them everything, then on the back end, we will normalize relations with you. And that came after 9/11, where the Saudis were very falling under pressure in the United States because a lot of the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. But what's happened from 2002 to 2020, 2023, is that the Middle East has changed and that these Arab states are suddenly feeling, hey, we have a lot of convergence of common interests with Israel because we're worried the United States is going to leave the Middle East for China, the Asia theater, and we will be stuck alone here. We are worried that oil, we could see, could be coming to an end, and that we have to diversify and digitize our economies. Who could help us with technology? And we know that Gulf leaders have looked at Israel's GDP and said, wow, this technology is amazing. They don't have oil, and yet their GDP is per capita is as high as ours. And then there's the issue of checking Iran, although it's a complex calculation for Gulf leaders, but it's something where Israel could be helpful there as well. So suddenly the Arab states said, listen, we've been waiting for the Palestinians for 20 years. We can't wait anymore. And they are starting to cut their own deals. The Emiratis, the Bahrainis, the Moroccans in 2020. And the U.S. is going to start to make a major push in 2023 with the Saudis. So traditionally, the Palestinians have not been thrilled, to put it mildly, because they feel this is kind of undermining their leverage. But now I think when it comes to Saudi Arabia, we're hearing Palestinian voices saying, you know what, we didn't love the Arab states going ahead of us, but they might have the leverage to get the Israelis to concede on things that we did not have. So it could be that the Palestinian calculation could be in flux as well, but you're 100% right in zeroing in on that calculation as a major shift in this whole conflict.
Can that happen with the leadership of the two sides being what they are now, or would it require a change of leadership and approach?
No, it's a great question, and we don't know fully the answer. The Saudis would say, listen, we're not going to solve this conflict for you. It's just too complicated, and no one else has solved it either. But we could at least help put something on the table for you that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. So, you know, would Abbas say, well, that's better than I have now, and I don't have to concede things, you know, in return. So that's fine. I think that's very possible. Netanyahu sees the Saudi deal as a legacy deal, but part of his coalition has hard right members. And I personally think these hard right people have nowhere else to go. And if it has to go to an election as a result, that's not so bad, even for Netanyahu, because he could go run the next election as a peacemaker with the Saudis. So he could maybe get some of those votes back. But Netanyahu is also very risk averse. And they'll say, listen, deal with the Saudis, fantastic. You know, nobody's against that. That's apple pie and motherhood. But why the Palestinian component might have a territorial dimension. And that's something in the hard right, they'll say, we can't live with that and we're going to have to leave your government. So if I was, you know, with the BBC or any other media, I would say, watch this space, because that is the new wild card here into the equation.
David Makovsky, my thanks to him and to Yolande Nell, Anshul Pfeffer and Khalil Shikaki. My conclusion is, well, I expect it to be extraordinarily gloomy at the end of all this, but actually it now seems that we should watch this Saudi space. And just before we go, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about the AI revolution, the one asking how we fix Britain's railways, and the one about how we get over 50s back to work. Briefing Room will be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Claire Bowes. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Neil Churchill. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Imagine if you could get hold of your favourite pop star's personal mobile phone. What might you find out?
I was like, this is a crime.
This is the story of how a group of Korean pop stars and their friends were caught sending each other videos of women they'd secretly filmed during sex, some of whom weren't even awake.
So what if she's unconscious?
You raped her.
An investigation that blew the lid off digital sex crimes in a country divided along gender lines.
The result of all this is a shattering of faith and trust in Korean men.
I'm Chloe Hajimatheu, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Burning Sun, part of the Intrigue podcast feed. All episodes are available now on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4. History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.